So we're continuing with respect to those and procedural rules. We spent some time on serving as an attorney or providing legal advice, so we covered that territory. And now we're going to speak about other procedural elements of a case which is brought in front of a Beis Din. So if you look at the questions posed, these are the questions that we're going to go through. We'll go through as many as we can this time around, and if we have any left over, that's why we keep on going. Okay, so number one, if Reuven wants to bring very simple and straightforward, but we'll try to bring actual cases and applications. If Reuven wants to bring a Din Torah against Shimon, where does he turn? We've heard all of this wonderful stuff about going to Beis Din. Beis Din is the true justice, it's divine justice. You're supposed to go to Beis Din, not go to Arkol. So we've discussed all of the different ins and outs and twists and turns of when one has to go to Beis Din, when one doesn't have to go to Beis Din. But how does the process work? Who do you call? Who do you approach? Number two, if Reuven wants to go to one Beis Din and Shimon elects a different Beis Din, what happens next? It's all fine and good if everybody agrees on which Beis Din to go to, but there's more than one Beis Din in the universe. The CRC is not the only act in this galaxy. In fact, it's not the only act in town. So what happens if the two parties can't agree on a particular Beis Din? Number three, what is the procedural process for sending a summons to Shimon? Reuven somehow figures out where to turn in order to locate a Beis Din, but Shimon has to be contacted. So what's the process for Shimon being contacted? Does Reuven tell Shimon, by the way, I'm taking you to a Din Torah? Is that something the Beis Din does? How does that work? Number four, does Reuven have to provide a detailed claim for Shimon to review? Is it enough for Reuven to just send a note saying, I'll see you in Beis Din? And then Shimon is left guessing as to exactly what Reuven is going to see him in Beis Din about until he shows up and finds out what exactly the claim is regarding. Or does Shimon have the right to find out more details about the claim that is being presented against him before he even shows up? Number five, how do Reuven and Shimon evidence their commitment to submit to a specific Beis Din? Everybody shows up, but what do they have to do at that point in time? They just start presenting their arguments in front of the Beis Din, or something else supposed to happen? Does the Beis Din schedule an appointment before there is some binding commitment on the part of the parties to abide by Beis Din? What exactly do they have to do? They have to sign a document, they have to sign an agreement. Assuming they have to sign an agreement, is there always a need to sign an arbitration agreement? That's question number six. Or can parties appear before the Beis Din sometimes without signing an agreement? Next, must the Beis Din issue a written decision? When the Beis Din hears all of the tainus, we're going to skip over right now the methodology for the Beis Din's decision making. We'll talk other times about Pshara, and we'll talk about Umdana and things like that. But when it comes to the actual issuance of a determination in the case, can that be done orally? The Gemara seems to talk about oral declarations being made by Beis Din at the conclusion of the case. Say, Ploni ata chai, Ploni ata zakai. Say, you are liable and you are off the hook. So if the Gemara indicates that could be done orally, so does it have to be in writing? Number eight, must the Beis Din spell out the reasons for a decision? And the Beis Din just thinks that if they're going to write the decision, can they just write, Ploni is chayev and Ploni is zakai? Reuven wins, Shimon loses. Have a nice day. What's the line at the end of Willy Wonka? Good day, good day, sir, you lose, right? So is that the way in which the proceeding comes to an end? And number nine, is there a right to appeal? Does the verdict end at the moment in which the Beis Din issues its decision? Or if one of the parties looks at the decision and says, you added up the numbers wrong, or you described the issue that was presented in the wrong fashion. We're arguing about who has the rights to a property on Fargo, and you wrote Jerome. So you have to correct the description of the award. Or one of the parties claims that there was an egregious error made as a matter of Jewish law. So is there a right to appeal? So those are the nine questions that are presented, and now we're going to just go through the basic sources and the basic applications.
Do the parties get to know which judges voted for them and which judges?
The Gemara says explicitly that the Beis Din simply says that from amongst us, this is the decision that was issued. That's the formulation.
It says it's unanimous or a split decision.
It doesn't matter, even if it's a split decision, let's say it's two against one, it's considered to be v'chilus. It's considered to be a form of Lashon Hara, according to the Gemara. to divulge which dayan said what. In fact, the dayanim are not allowed to go to the parties themselves and say, well, I really voted for you, but I got outvoted by the other two. You're not allowed to say that.
Okay.
You're not allowed to do that. Okay, so the Gemara in Moed Katan and Baba Kama kind of supplement each other with respect to the process of summoning somebody to Beis Din. So take a look at the Gemara Moed Katan. Everything has a scriptural source. So all of the procedures that we follow in Beis Din is all modeled after things that happened in the Torah, in the written Torah. It's just, you can find psukim for everything. So Rabbi asked me, and the shlicha de Beis Din. So what would happen? Reuven has a case against Shimon, so he would go to Beis Din and say, I have a case against Shimon, I want you to summon Shimon. So how do we know that the Beis Din sends its court officer? That would be the administrator of the Beis Din. Like here in the CRC, we have a Beis Din administrator. Rabbi Abramson, you know Rabbi Abramson? So he's the Beis Din administrator. When I was working at the Beis Din of America as the director, so I was the Beis Din administrator. So it's my job to send out a summons to the parties who were summoned to the Beis Din. So how do we know that a Beis Din administrator has this task? It says when Moshe had a dispute with Dothan and Aviram, when they were up in revolt against Moshe for the rebellion of Korach, so he sent a messenger to call them over. How do we know that there's such an institution as sending a summons for a din Torah? Moshe sent out to Korach and said, you and all the people who are bringing actions against me, who are trying to depose me from my position, so I want a din Torah against you. Likmei gava rabba. How do we know that you're supposed to say in front of which Beis Din? Like the Moshe's Beis Din that he went in front of was HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is adjudicating the case. When Hashem decides the case, he could do things like having the earth open up its mouth and swallow everybody. You know, so this is a pretty high-powered case. So how do you know that you announce? So who is the Beis Din? Who's the judge who's presiding? Because it says, "Diksil lifnei Hashem." So you have to say which Beis Din it's in front of. So that has to be on the summons. The summons has to say the name of the Beis Din. It's very important. Sometimes a party will get a summons from a Beis Din. I'll get a call from somebody who received the summons saying, is this a legitimate Beis Din? Because you have to make sure it's legitimate. It's really in front of a Gabba Rabba. Because there are illegitimate Batei Din running around. One person just holds up a shingle and the whole Beis Din doesn't really have any legitimacy at all.
That's all the Mishnah, if you go back to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, that all it requires are basically three conscious Jews.
Well, they have to be conscious and conscientious as well. So sometimes they're conscious, but they're not so conscientious.
That's not what the Mishnah says.
Absolutely, you have to have people who are Gomer V'Savir, and they follow the criteria of not being corrupt. Now, people can take upon themselves voluntarily. With Shlosha Roi Bakar, they could take three shepherds from the field who don't necessarily have stellar reputations, but that's only if they accept them upon themselves. But in order for Beis Din to have jurisdiction to require people to appear before them, so there has to be a certain measure of integrity. Atu Palnia, how do you know that you're supposed to mention the name of the other party too? When you summon a defendant, you summon Shimon to come to Beis Din, the Beis Din has to say that Reuven is bringing the case against you. I mean, if he's Shimon, so he should know that it's always Reuven is bringing the case against him. But, you know, maybe he's a sucker. You know, it might be Reuven, it might be Shimon, it might be Levi. So how do you know you say the name of the plaintiff? Diksev Atav Ehem Be'Aaron. Moshe mentioned all of the different parties. You and they and Aaron. You have a complaint against Aaron. You don't think he should be Kohen Gadol. Tekavin and Zimna, how do you know that the Beis Din also has to establish a time? Beis Din has to give a time that they're prepared to hear the case, or a time within which the party who receives the summons is obligated to respond. So in our typical Beis Din summons, it will say there are two different approaches that are followed by Batei Din nowadays. One approach is to actually set a time. So you're summoned to come to the Beis Din, and we're prepared to hear the case next Thursday. And other Batei Din are not so presumptuous. They don't necessarily assume that Shimon is going to agree to appear before their Beis Din. Maybe Shimon will appear before a different Beis Din. So they'll say, you have to respond by next Thursday as to whether you're going to agree to submit in front of us or to name a different Beis Din. A lot of that depends on whether we're dealing with a Beis Din that has automatic jurisdiction because they're the only act in town, because they're the only Beis Din. But if they're not the only act in town, so then it's still Kavin and Zimna. There's still a time that has to be set, but the time that could be set could be a time that's set within which the party receiving the summons has to respond whether or not they're going to come to this Beis Din or a different Beis Din. How do we know? Yes.
In town, that's geography. But if I'm a Sephardi, no, I want to go to a Sephardi Beis Din, which is in a different city. Or if I'm Vizhnitz, I want to go to Vizhnitz Beis Din, not Chicago. It's not geography. Can you choose which Beis Din you feel more comfortable with?
It used to be geography because it would be understood that people from a certain geographical area or followed similar customs. In America, it's more complicated because in America, you have people who are coming from lots of different communities from elsewhere where they're not necessarily, everyone's in Chicago, they're not necessarily, it could be Kilichol Am in Chicago, but despite the fact that everyone is in Chicago, they're made up of disparate groups, that some came right. from Matala, yeah, and right. some came from Khadarov. And
or
some
Chabad may came, want to go to Crown Heights.
Right, and some are the Lubavitcher Hasidim, and some are Weitzner, and some are this,
so
that, and the
so
other
what,
thing.
So what's the answer?
So that's why, as we'll see, we don't have this concept of there being one size fits all nowadays, that we have different Bati Din even within one city nowadays.
What about subject matter expertise?
Subject matter expertise, that's the job of the Beis Din to make sure that they convene Dayanim who are knowledgeable about a case or who can be trusted to consult with experts when it comes to a particular area. We mentioned in the past that if there's a particular industry and the custom of that industry, that is that all disputes get decided by an arbitration panel made up of experts in the industry and they're not part of the court system, so then one party can say, I want to go in front of the experts in my industry who know what the customs and practices are of the industry. So Rabbi Akiva Eger says that that's a legitimate taina. Even if it's not a Beis Din at all, that's a legitimate taina. So if you're talking about that type of thing, so that could be a valid claim as well. Bizimna basa zimna. How do we know that if the defendant didn't, Lushima, didn't respond to the first summons, that you give him another chance, that you summon him again? Talking about the king of Paro, in some context in Tanakh, who did not respond properly within the time frame that he was given, and therefore he is going to be placed in some type of excommunication. And how do we know that if the administrator of the Beis Din is treated shabbily, where the defendant does not respond respectfully, but instead tells the Shliach Beis Din where he can go, so how do we know that the Shliach Beis Din is allowed to report the insolent and disrespectful manner in which he was treated, and it's not considered to be like Lashon Hara, because the report was brought back to Moshe Rabbeinu regarding the insubordination of Dasan Vaviram, when he was told, that even if they have their eyes gouged out, they're not going to go up and agree to submit to the authority of the Beis Din, or the authority of the court to which they had been summoned. We know in the Shemisham Tinan. And how do we know that there's a seruv that gets issued against parties who are recalcitrant and they refuse to come to Beis Din? Tiksiv Omei Ruz says that with respect to those who did not want to join in the battle, that they would be placed in, they weren't prepared to submit to being summoned, right? Vava was summoning people to join in the battle and they weren't prepared to join in the battle. So we say that they're going to be cursed. How do we know that we put people not only in a seru, but we would put people in a more strict type of cherem? It says, oh, arur is a curse, and the Gemara goes on and on to describe how the person who is in defiance of their obligation to submit to Beis Din can be put in a very strict excommunication, where people would not even be allowed to sit near them, or to interact with them, or to do business with them. And then the Gemara talks about the procedural rules if a seruv is issued against somebody. So let's say that the person ends up complying with the Beis Din, they end up finally relenting and discharging their halachic obligations. So are they entitled to have the seruv removed? So the Gemara has a principle, a general protocol, which is tut aser v'tut shari. That you ever hear the tututututi goodbye? So you have tut aser v'tut shari, then you have a little whistle that causes a person to be put into the seruv. Whatever action the Beis Din took, they issued a letter. If they issued a letter to put the person into seruv, so they can issue a letter to take the person out of seruv. A tut is like a tut of a horn, a shofar. It might be a shofar that gets blown to put people. You know, you ever see kind of like the old Yiddish movies, you know, you're putting somebody in cherem, so everybody gets together, and there's a dark room in the rabbi's house, and they blow the shofar.
Black shofar.
Right? Yes, okay. So
you
blow the shofar to put someone in cherem, or to exercise the dipik, or whatever they're doing. So it's through a shofar. You what?
It's a solemn
occasion. The two chari, and then you blow the shofar again. It's a happier blowing of the shofar in order to get a person out of the chayim. So we don't have that's like from shocha yovel hema yaluvahar, right? They blew the shofar and then everybody could go back to the mountain. So it's even if it's not a shofar, whatever methodology is used to put somebody in chayim, so the person is taken out of chayim. So we've had that in cases. Generally speaking, if a person, let's say that there's a recalcitrant husband is refusing to submit to Bezdin with respect to a get claim that was brought by his wife, so the Bezdin, when I put him into put a seiruv upon him, then it's understood that once he complies, let's say he comes into Bezdin and he gives the get, so it's understood that the seiruv is no longer operative. In most cases that I have dealt with over the years, I've not received explicit requests for there to be a letter issued explicitly removing the seiruv that was previously issued by the Bezdin. But when there have been such requests, so we follow the protocol of tudas or tuchari. Mm-hmm. So we just issue another letter saying the person is no longer in seiruv. There was a case that the Bezdin of America dealt with in which the fellow who was put into, had a seiruv issued against him for refusing to comply with respect to a get case, said he wanted to see the letter. He wanted the letter to be prepared so he could approve the letter that would be removing the seiruv before he gave his wife a get. So he wanted the letter to say, not only is the seiruv removed, but the seiruv never should have been issued in the first place. And we made a terrible mistake by issuing the seiruv. So there's such a thing as the lusa de beidina. You can't have a complete mockery made out of the Bezdin process. So much. That's more than a tut shari. That's the person putting more than their, putting their tut sense into the tut. So that we don't allow.
What does tut mean?
Will come priority?
Tut means like a whistle, like a blowing of a shofar, like a horn.
The guy's going to insist.
Yeah.
And the wife would not get a get without that. Would the butter spin be mofa on the cover to do it being shumaguna?
It's a good question. So the answer is that you have to also be cognizant of what the Bezdin is going to be encouraging for the future. If the perception is that anybody could just make a mockery of the Bezdin and say, okay, why don't all the members of the Bezdin take off their clothes and to dance a jig in the middle of the highway naked, and then I'll give my wife a get, so that I don't think would be productive towards the process of people having respect for the Bezdin in the future. So you have to know how to draw the lines. It is a very good question. It's a very good question.
What happened in this case?
In that particular case, I don't think that the fellow gave the get right away.
Really?
Yeah. I think that the Bezdin came up with a lushan that was very generous. Very generous. Said that it will turn out retroactively that the fellow was a tzaddik all along, and therefore not the sort of fellow who would have deserved to have a seiruv issued against him. Whatever would have been a legitimate lushan for that any respectable court could have issued under the circumstances, really stretching it to the hilt. But you can only stretch so far. I think that sometimes you call the person's bluff, and it's clear that they weren't really serious altogether anyway. So then the second source is really the supplementary source in Baba Kama Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, which tells you exactly what is the time frame for giving a person the opportunity to come to Bezdin. So Chista says, Kovin Zman Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni, that the person would be summoned to come to Bezdin the following Monday, and then if they wouldn't come Monday, they'd be summoned Thursday, and then the following Monday, three times. So it's a three-time process. So the Gemara tells us that the number of summonses that should be issued is three times, and that is our practice nowadays, that before issuing a seiruv, a person is given three opportunities to have a letter of summons, a letter of invitation issued to them. So if they didn't respond to the first one or the second one, the Bezdin does not punish them immediately. Even though, if you look at the Gemara there, the Gemara says that it really depends on whether this is a person who is known to be in town or a person that you have to worry that they went out of town. The Gemara tells a story that there was a woman who was summoned to Bezdin in the evening, and then in the morning, they wrote a seiruv against them. So the question was raised. Amalei Rabasi asked the question. The Rav Kahana issued the seiruv. Lo sevel amala hadi amar Rav Chista kovin zman sheni v'chamishi v'sheni. Didn't you learn that you're supposed to give a person three chances? So amalei, three strikes before you're out. So amalei hani mili gava. Says that's a man. To honest, lays to be masa, because he's constantly going back and forth business. So you don't know. Maybe he's not around. when the letter arrives in the mailbox. Maybe he didn't see it. Well, this is so, but the woman, she's staying at home. She's not going anywhere. She was in the city. She knew that the summons arrived. So she's a rebel without a cause. She's a rebel against the Besdin, and therefore a seir can be issued immediately.
So, and you're with no disrespect to you or the Gemara or, you know, sexism, you're comfortable with that being a legal line of reasoning that, oh, a woman is generally at home, so she's not entitled to the same level of service as a man?
It's a factual reality. If you look at the way the Shulchan Aruch, I'm going to answer the question. If you look at the way the Shulchan Aruch codifies the halacha, there's no distinction made between men and women. The point of the way in which the Shulchan Aruch understands the Gemara is just talking about whatever the reality of the situation is. Meaning that if you're dealing with a person who regularly travels on business between one city and another city, and where there is a reasonable excuse that the person might not have received the first or second summons, so then that is when you give the person the forbearance of three different summonses. But if you're dealing with a person, whether it's a woman in the days of the Gemara, if the sociological reality was that women didn't travel, or whether it's a man, who where it's known that the man is at home and it's known that the man received the summons, so then there is no magical formula of three strikes that you have to give the person three different opportunities. However, nonetheless, the Aruch HaShulchan says that nowadays we give everybody the opportunity for three different summonses, and the reason is because you never really know 100%. People are very, very busy, and therefore they might be distracted, they might be preoccupied, they might not have focused properly. We give a person a certain amount of latitude. I can tell you that one of the most difficult things in the Besdin world is having to issue a seiruv against somebody because it's an order of recalcitrance, it's a contempt order, and it really puts a person in a very compromised position within the community. If a seiruv is issued against somebody, so the other party might decide to start posting the seiruv on bulletin boards and all of the different shuls, and the shuls might decide they're not going to give the person any honors or aliyahs or have people invite the person to their simchos. I mean, there are all kinds of very serious social repercussions that can result from a person receiving a seiruv, and therefore Bati Din in general are hesitant to issue a seiruv until they have determined that it's absolutely 100% necessary and they've given every single possible chance to the individual. On the other hand, if you're dealing with an individual, and this is what is described as apkirusa de Beit Din, that's what is described in source Dalet here in Shulchan Aruch Siman Yud Aleph Sif Aleph, you summon somebody and the very first time that they receive the summons, it's not that they're asking for more time or they ignore it or blow up the Besdin the first time, but they are downright abusive towards the Besdin. The Shliach Besdin, the administrator, hands them or emails them the seiruv, and they respond in an incredibly disrespectful and rude and obnoxious fashion, showing that they have a zero respect for the Besdin or for the entire process, and they are incredibly defiant towards their Jewish law obligations. So if they show that type of disrespect for the process, what we call apkirusa de beidina, in the manner in which they respond, so then a seiruv can be issued immediately. Under those circumstances, there's no excuse to say, oh, the person isn't sufficiently focusing upon it, the person is preoccupied. We know what the person's answer is. That's the equivalent to, you don't need three strikes when the person, you know, swings and throws and gets out immediately. In this particular case, the person just showed that they are not interested in the process and that they are rejecting the process. So under those circumstances, a seiruv can certainly be issued right away. We've had that. We've had people who have demonstrated absolute contempt for the Besdin. And sometimes it's even in the manner in which they indicate a willingness to submit to a Besdin process. I remember once we summoned somebody who said, you have the option, you can go to this Besdin or you can name a different Besdin. So the person said, yes, I'm going to choose a different Besdin. I'm going to form the Besdin myself. You know, I'm going to decide who the rabbis are for the Besdin, who should hear the case, and I'll let you know when I've made up my mind about that. So that also is a contemptuous response. If a person responds in a contemptuous fashion, you can point out to them, maybe you give them the benefit of the doubt, they don't realize it's contemptuous. So you write them a letter saying, you know, you can't really do that because that would really compromise the integrity of the process. It has to be an objective bezin. It can't just be people that you name, and you have to give a timetable in which you're going to suggest the bezin. You can't just say whenever you get around to it because that's really disrespect to the bezin. And you can give the person, you know, that benefit of the doubt and then give them another chance. But there's a limit to the amount of forbearance when it appears pretty clear that a person is being contemptuous to the Bezdin. Sometimes, you know, the person is just cursing the Bezdin and responding in a violent, vituperative fashion, so it becomes a little bit ridiculous and also somewhat disrespectful to the Bezdin process as well to say that you're going to be forbearing under those circumstances. You have to have an obligation of respect for what the Bezdin represents in the eyes of a Kaddish Baruch Hu as well. You have to remember that the boss that you're working with also has to be treated with dignity. And therefore, under those circumstances, the seir can be issued earlier. But one of the most common complaints that I do get in working on Bezdin cases is, how come you haven't issued a seir yet? Because people who are indignant about having their cases brought in front of Bezdin, who feel that the other side is just blowing off the Bezdin and putting them off, really want very, very badly that a seir should be issued, that there should be some sort of a contempt order issued. And I always point out that the main focus of Bezdin is to adjudicate cases justly and fairly. It's not our major focus to put people in cherib, to excommunicate people or to shame people publicly. That's not really our focus. It might be our responsibility if a person is showing disrespect to or contempt for the Bezdin, but that's not really our focus. That's not what we're trying to accomplish. So therefore, you try as much as possible to give postponements, to give to grant requests for a deferral or a response, but at a certain point, you have to recognize the reality of the situation that a seiruv is warranted.
Rabbi,
okay? Yes.
Just on a tangential point you made, you know, given that the other than you, the other two dayanim are known in the city involved with synagogues, if it would come to a situation where the two of them would ask to be recused because of their relationship with the parties, does the CRC have, I guess, backup dayanim?
Well, yes, but that's a different story too. If there's a question about the impartiality of the judges, so obviously that's a different procedural point, that you can't have judges who have a conflict of interest or where there's a feeling that they wouldn't be able to be impartial. So in those cases, of course, you would appoint backup judges to hear
the
cases.
So you have a roster of backup.
We have people who would be utilized in those circumstances. Sure. You know, sometimes when you're dealing with a small town Bezdin, it's very, very difficult to have a situation where the Dayanim don't know the parties altogether. But there are two different types of relationship issues that Dayanim have to deal with when they have some knowledge of the parties. One is where the Dayanim have to disqualify themselves because they have an interest in the case, because they're so close with the parties that it's practically as if the Dayanim would be an extension of one of the litigants in the case. And the other is where it's merely a disclosure issue, where there isn't a sufficient connection or relationship either to the parties or the subject matter of the cases, where the Dayanim would need to disqualify themselves, but because they know the parties to some degree, they need to disclose any relationship and make sure that the other party is comfortable with whatever relationship the Dayanim might have with their counterpart. What I have found very interestingly in my experience here in Chicago was, in New York we didn't have this issue nearly as much, because in New York there are many different communities and there are lots of people whom you might not even know within 2 degrees of separation. Here in Chicago, like, 1 degree of separation is a lot. So when it's a smaller town community, I find that it's more taken for granted by the parties that there will be some familiarity. And therefore, as long as the Dayanim are very upfront about their relationship with the parties, and say, I daven at the same minyan as this person, sometimes we say good Shabbos to each other, whatever the nature of the relationship might be, or this was a person that he's a doctor in the community and I've gone to him a couple of times, whatever it happens to be, I find that the parties are not bothered by that. That generally speaking, that is not, as long as the Dayanim are comfortable feeling that they could be objective in the case, the parties usually are comfortable with that as well. But it's very, very important to disclose. If a party would be uncomfortable, then of course the Dayan should recuse himself from the case. There's nothing to speak about. Okay, so that's a good question, because obviously when the Dayanim actually convene, any relationships of that sort have to be shared fully, 100%. That's a part of the process, and the smaller the town, the more integral a part of the process that will end up being, because it's going to come up on a very regular basis in many, many different cases. And sometimes it could be such that there is such a strong relationship between a party and the dayanim of the city that it will be impossible for anybody to really hear the case within that town, and therefore dayanim have to be brought in from the outside in order to hear a particular case, depending on who we're talking about.
Can it be waived if the judge is a korov, a relative of one of the parties? Can the other party waive it, or no, the judge is puzzled?
You know what, it can be waived, but what we would say in such a case is that if the dayan is actually a korov, we would say that that really is grounds for disqualification. We really would not want, if we're talking about a respectable institutional bezdin, we would not want a dayan to hear a case if he was dealing with an actual korov. If you're dealing with an actual korov, you really have to recuse yourself from the case. I don't really think that there's a way out. I mean, maybe if you're dealing with a fifth cousin three times removed, so, you know, that's a different story, and you didn't even know the person was your fifth cousin three times removed and just discover that afterwards through some, you know, genealogical site. So that's a different story. But if the person's, you know, a close korov, so obviously that would be expected. So now if you go on, so what happens then when a person is summoned to come to the Beis Din, and they don't blow up the Beis Din. They don't say that I'm refusing to come to the Beis Din. They don't curse out the Shliach Beis Din. But their taina is that they want to go to a different Beis Din. Maybe they want to go to a more prestigious Beis Din. So that's what the Shulchan Aruch talks about in Siman Yudalet. Shulchan Aruch says, I have two people who are involved in a Din Torah, and one person sends the summons. He goes to the Beis Din, a Beis Din, and he sends the summons. So the other one says, no, I want to go to Beis Din Agadol. I want to go to the big Beis Din Agadol in Yerushalayim that's all the very prestigious. So we say a person doesn't have the right to insist on going to a Beis Din outside of the city. We say, Kopenos to Vidan Be'ira. We require the person to have the case adjudicated in the city. They do not have the right. The defendant doesn't have the right to say, let's go to a different place, even if it's a more prestigious Beis Din. All right? Now,
there's an exception in Gemara Sanhedrin, and the Suri, I think.
No, Suri is a different story. That's where there was no Beis Din in the city to handle the case, and the Beis Din says that even if there is no qualified Beis Din, so then we actually go so far as to bring people who would not otherwise be qualified and appoint them to be dayanim, and then when they have questions to ask, they'll ask a dayanim from a different city who are more knowledgeable, but they still will be the ones adjudicating the case. That's what the Gemara refers to as arkos shebesuria. That's the specific term I think that you're referring to. And then there's a process that's described in terms of if there is a greater Beis Din, then the one who is forced to litigate the case in front of the Beis Din here in this city can say, well, I want that other Beis Din at least to review the verdict after the verdict is issued. So that's what the Shulchan Aruch talks about over here. All right. Now, there's a very important principle that's articulated in the Shulchan Aruch Siman Yudal, on page 3 here, which is HaToveya Tzarech Leilech Achar HaNitba. The Toveya is supposed to go after the Nitba. I have a plaintiff, I have a defendant. We don't require the defendant to go to the place of the plaintiff. We say the plaintiff should go to the place of the defendant. Now, there are exceptions to this rule, like, for example, where the transaction between the parties took place in a particular city, and then the defendant runs off to New Zealand or something. So we're not going to say when the actual place of the contact and the transaction and the business between the parties was in Chicago, and then the NITPA, the defendant, decides to run off to New Zealand, which had no nexus, no connection with the transaction. So then we're not necessarily going to say that the plaintiff has to go after the defendant. But if the transaction took place in the defendant's home, or it didn't take place more in the plaintiff's place of residence than it did in the defendant's place of residence, so then the general principle that we follow is that you have to go after the defendant's place. So let's say I have a plaintiff who lives in Chicago and the defendant lives in California. So the plaintiff can insist on the case being heard in a Beis Din in Chicago. The defendant has the right to say, I want this case to be heard by a Beis Din that's sitting in California. That would be the general rule when it comes to Hokin Achara Nitva. Yes?
Why does it have to be, why does a Beis Din have to be geographically grounded?
So the reason here, when we talk about it being geographically grounded, is because we don't consider it to be fair. Somebody is summoned to a bezdin just because a person is summoned, so why should they be inconvenienced? Generally speaking, we have a principle in halacha, which is hamotzi mechavero ala paraya. If somebody has a claim against the other person, they have to prove the claim. So we don't inconvenience somebody who is summoned to answer to a claim in a fashion which would indicate that they already bear some measurement of guilt just because they've been summoned. So that to require them to buy a plane ticket and to have to, or a train, or to have to travel somewhere else is already imposing some sort of a guilt upon them that they have to make such a tremendous expenditure just because somebody else is suing them. So it's one thing if there's an equitable reason why they should have to travel because the claim had originated in this other location, but the claim didn't originate in the other location, so why should they have to travel just because the plaintiff happened to have moved away or lived somewhere else?
Or asking the other way, why not where the transaction or the conflict
so that for sure, if the transaction, as I said, if the transaction took place in the plaintiff's locale, so then that's a different story. Then we would have more of an argument to say the Nitpa should go after that. It should have to travel to that place. But here we're working with the assumption that the transaction didn't take place in one place more than the other. Maybe it was a contract where both of them could be where they live. There were goods that were transported from one place to another place. And therefore, there's no reason in which we would say that the plaintiff's place was a more prominent part of the transaction.
So you had an internet transaction, for example.
Right, an internet transaction would be also a very, very good example. They're not going to, I guess you would have to hear that case, via Skype or something, on social media.
It's a bigger problem. I did some research on this and wrote some articles on this. Most big internet companies, if you were to go to Situs, meaning the location of the principality, it'd be somewhere in the Fiji Islands or something.
And we're not going to require anybody to go there.
Server farm in Rhodesia.
Right. Yeah. So again, we're working with the assumption that the transaction took place as much in the defendant's neck of the woods as it did anywhere else, and therefore it's just not appropriate to have to transplant the defendant from his location.
Are there specific jurisdictional rules like there are in civil law? For example, the proper jurisdiction for a real estate dispute is in the locale of the real estate, things like that.
Yeah, Rav Eliyav Shochetman wrote a book called Seder Hadin. Rav Eliyav Shochetman is a big, Talmid Chacham and halakhic scholar who lives in Eretz Yisrael. He writes a Mishpat Ivri. He writes on kind of what are the laws and principles that are followed by the official Bate Din Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. So in his book, Seder Hadin, he talks about these different scenarios. So he says that if you had a business transaction where the office of the business and where the transaction of this particular case took place in the location where the plaintiff lives, and then the defendant just happened to move elsewhere, so then we would say that if the most of the connections to this claim took place in the location of the plaintiff, then we would very often give the prerogative of to the plaintiff to require that the defendant to litigate the case in the place where the business is located and where the transaction took place. So you do look at all of those different criteria in making this determination. But in a vacuum where you don't have those considerations, we would say Hochin Acharei Nitpa. That's the general principle. But then the question becomes, does Hochin Acharei Nitpa mean that the Nitpa gets to name the Bezdin, or just that the Nitpa, the defendant, gets it to set the location? And this is a very, very important question because, as we will see in source above, not always do you only have one bezdin in the location of a particular party. So, let's say that there are two great scholars who live in one city, and they both represent different bati din. So one of the litigants can say, they can say, I don't necessarily want to go to the bezdin of one person's, of one party's choice. I want to go to the other bezdin if there is a choice of more than one bezdin in a particular city. Even though the bezdin that the defendant, say, wants to go to is a less prestigious bezdin, the one that the plaintiff wants to go to, since they're both in the city, they're both in the location of the defendant, so therefore that's considered to be on equal footing. So then the question becomes, Does that mean that either that if the nitba, for example, says, I want to go to one of the two bati din, that the nitba can say, can demand that this be the one that he wants to go to? This is very relevant for any location, like here in Chicago, or the plaintiff wants to go to Chicago Rabbinical Council. And the defendant says, no, I want to go to Aguda or something like that, or vice versa. So who gets to call the shots? Who gets to call the shots? So if you look in the Bar HaGola, the Bar HaGola doesn't normally inject his own opinion or interpretation of a halakha. He generally just gives you the sources where the halakha comes from. But here, the Bar HaGola gives you an actual interpretation. He says, Pirish, what would happen? Since either one can stop the other one from insisting on a particular bezin in that location, that doesn't mean, says the Bar HaGola, that the defendant gets to decide that the bezin that he wants in that location is the bezin that adjudicates the case. It just means that now that they can't agree on a bezin, neither one has the right to insist on a particular bezin, and they will have to come to some sort of a mutual agreement as to which bezin they both are comfortable with. That Reuven chose a bezin CRC, Shimon said bezin Aguda, and now they say, well, neither one of us wants the other one's bezin, so we'll go to bezin of, I don't know, Hoshimish Bakola, whatever. They'll come up with some a third choice within the community that will be satisfactory to both of them. But then that begs the question, what if there is no third choice that's satisfactory to both of them?
Didn't we learn previously that each of the two Bate Din would choose a Dayan, and those two Dayanim would choose a third one?
Well, there is such a concept, right, as to each person choosing a Dayan, that's called Zabla, right? So the Gemara says that you could have a Zabla type of a panel which is set up, but the Gemara goes further. The Gemara says you could do that lechatzkila, you could do that from the outset. A plaintiff can say, I want a Zabla, or a defendant can say, I want a Zabla, not even name a particular Bezdin. What's a Zabla? Zabla means Zeb Bor Lo Echad. It means that each party chooses one Dayan, and then the two Dayanim choose the third Dayan, right? That's the idea of Zabla. We're not talking about Zabla here, though, because here we're talking about where each one said, no, I want an established institutional Bezdin. So what happens? So look at the Nesivos HaMishpat, source Zayin. So he says that he starts off a little bit like the Bar HaGola, that each one can insist that they don't want to go to the other one's name bezdin, until they come to some sort of a pshara, they come to some sort of an agreement regarding one bezdin that they are all comfortable with. But what happens if they're not able to come to some sort of a settlement? So the Nesivos gives you a prescription, very, very interesting. He says, well, in that case, you know what should happen? Rather than turning it into a zabla, where each one's going to choose a Dayan, since I have two respectable Bate Din involved, let the two Bate Din sit together. Let the two Bate Din form a joint Bezdin together. That's much better.
And you have an even number, though.
So they'll work out an even number. So they will then choose one person to be the swing vote, okay? Then they'll agree upon who should be the individual from which Bezdin will be the swing vote. But the point is they will form that Bezdin together. So we had this just a year or so ago. I had a case where there was somebody from California. It was a divorce case involving two parties from California. Husband in California, wife in California. So the wife wanted to summon the husband to appear before the Bezdin of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, which is a little bit odd, right? Because it's not the Makom HaToveh and it's not the Makom HaNitba. The plaintiff didn't live here and the defendant didn't live here. They're both husband and wife. They both lived in California. So we, therefore, were not comfortable even sending out a summons in the first place, because since the principle is Hokhin Achara Nitva, you go after the place of the defendant, and the defendant clearly had no connection to Chicago per se. What we did was we called up the main Bezdin in California. There were a few, but we called up the main Bezdin in California, and we said, would you be offended by our sending out our summons, in this case, to the husband, since the wife approached us? What was the argument? The argument was that the wife claimed that the husband was so well known in the California area that it would be difficult to find a Bezdin that wouldn't have some type of a relationship with the husband. So if you take a look at the end of the Shulchan Aruch in Sif Hey, the last line says, Ashim Muksak V'Alam V'Iro, if you have somebody who's either very rich or is very powerful in their city, Motsin Osaladun V'Irachar. So under those circumstances, you can require the person to be brought to a different city for the adjudication. Afabisha Bezdin Shibiyo Yote Gadol, even though the Bezdin in their city is considered more prestigious than the Bezdin in the other city. I've had that in the other case, in other contexts as well. We had a case where we went to some place in Ohio where there was a major community dispute, and the feeling was the Yonim over there were too embroiled themselves with the parties and with the subject matter of the dispute that they could not be counted upon to, or they themselves were not even comfortable with the notion of their sitting on the case to adjudicate the case. So therefore, they brought in three Dayanim from the outside, well, two Dayanim from New York and one Dayan myself from Chicago, to come and to sit and adjudicate this case, because it was felt that it was too much of a cause celebre case within the community that it would have been unreasonable to expect Dayanim rabbis from that community to actually sit on the case. But you can have it in the reverse direction as well. Not that you're bringing in Dayanim from the outside, but where you say that under these circumstances we're going to require a party who otherwise would not be obligated to leave their own turf for the case to be brought against them, to leave their turf if the feeling is that there's no Bezdin in their area who could reasonably hear the case. Now what happens to the Bezdin in California in this particular instance didn't feel the same way that the wife felt. They didn't feel that they were so connected to the husband that they couldn't reasonably hear the case. But nonetheless, they gave us their blessings. They said, the wife wants to summon the husband to your bezdin. Let's see what happens. Maybe he'll want to go to your bezdin. We doubt it, but maybe he'll want to go to your bezdin. So the husband predictably responded, no, I don't want to go to the bezdin in Chicago. I want to go to that very same bezdin that I spoke to in California. That was the bezdin of the Rabbinical Council of California. So then, instead of just throwing the case away to the wolves and saying, well, the two parties can't agree on a particular bezdin, we came together with the Rabbinical Council of California, with whom we had been in touch since the inception of the case anyway, and we said, let's turn collectively back to the parties and say, no problem, we're going to form a joint bezdin between the two of us. And that's what we did. So we did exactly what the Nasi was prescribed. I had to go to California for some other bezdin matter, some other bezdin business. I think I was giving a speech about prenuptial agreements or something like that. So since I was in town anyway, so we arranged for a meeting in which I joined together. I agreed to join with two of the dayanim. You asked, how are you going to get the third? I said, no problem, I'll sit. I told the wife that from my perspective, it was not a problem to sit with two of the dayanim of the bezdin over there, that I was perfectly comfortable with them, but she wanted me to be sitting on the panel. So I sat with two of the dayanim from the Rabbinical Council of California. We sat down with the two parties and we worked out the case. So that's exactly along the lines of what the Nesivos is speaking about. So that's sort of an ideal way of dealing with this situation where the two parties, that works out well when the two Batei Din have a good working relationship. You can never take it for granted that any two Jewish institutions are going to have a good working relationship with each other, much less two Batei Din, but we have, Baruch Hashem, a good working relationship. And this is exactly as you said, Dr. Chasen, Vahave Ke'en Zebor Lo Echad, that it's along the lines of a Zabal. It's like a Zebor Lo Echad, except that you're dealing with institutions rather than individuals. You're dealing with the two Batei Din working together. And then the Nesivos was no knave. He said, "V'mishnei habati din ain't a motim l'shevus yachad." And if it should happen, if you can imagine, you know, such an odd series of events where the Batei Din themselves would not want to actually form a mutual bezdin together, azai. So then the Nesivos gives you achua. He gives you a bottom line. He says, "You know what? In such a case, hanipa kocho gadol, the one who is the defendant, and then has the upper hand, because after all." We say, and if the Batei Din are not prepared to sit together, then the Nitpa gets to choose which Bezdin he wants to go to. Since you can't compel him to go elsewhere when he says that he really wants to go to a particular Bezdin, to a specific Bezdin, and if the Bezdin chosen by the plaintiff is not prepared to work together with the Bezdin chosen by the defendant, so then that would be the place where he would end up going. So that's very, very interesting, because I can tell you that this is not the common practice. The common practice among Batei Din is really along the lines of the Ber Hagola, which is that they should come up with a mutual bezdin that they're both comfortable with. Some have proposed that what should happen in these cases is that the defendant should name three respectable batei din, meaning three batei din who have not been completely discredited. There are batei din who have been discredited, meaning there are batei din where, for example, the Rabbanut HaRashit, the chief rabbi of Israel, has issued letters saying that this is a completely discredited and unrecognized bezdin. There's a certain bezdin in Muncie that they wrote this about, because that was a bezdin that was known to use intimidation tactics, that was known to engage in practices that were not considered to be on the up and up, and they actually issued a letter saying that this is not considered to be a reputable bezdin. But otherwise, the range of reputable batei din is pretty broad, meaning there's certain batei din that people might not like per se, but that's still considered to be within the range of respectability. So what's been suggested is that maybe a defendant should have to simply, if they can't agree on a bezdin, so then a defendant should name three respectable batei din, and then the plaintiff will be obligated to choose one of those batei din. That's one of the proposals that's been suggested. But this notion that if there isn't an agreement, a bezdin hashavah that's agreed upon, that the nitpa just gets to call the shots and can insist that the toveah go to the nitpa's bezdin, so that is generally not the practice that's followed. But the question is, if that's not the practice that's followed, so what rights, what privileges does the toveah, does a plaintiff have under those circumstances? Can a plaintiff say, okay, well, I don't want to go to the bezdin that's named by the defendant, and therefore you should issue a seiruv, a contempt order against the defendant? Well, according to the Nesibos, it isn't really fair to issue a contempt order against the defendant. The defendant says, I only want to go to this particular bezdin. It's a respectable bezdin, just the plaintiff doesn't want to go to that bezdin, and the defendant has presumably the nesibus to rely upon in saying that I don't have to choose a different bezdin. And if there isn't some sort of a community-wide takana, there is no enactment that says, well, the defendant has to come up with two other batei din to name. We haven't, you know, reached that point where everybody has come to that consensus. So it's very difficult, in my opinion, to issue a contempt order against a defendant in those situations. So what we have to come to the conclusion to do in these types of cases over the years is to say we're not going to issue a contempt order against the defendant. We will say to the plaintiff that since the consensus is not like the nesivus, that the defendant gets to call the shots, what we will say is that under those circumstances we'll give a heter or kos to the plaintiff. We'll give a heter or kos that will say to the plaintiff that you have the right to bring your case to civil court, but we're not going to issue a contempt order under those circumstances. And there are batei din that will go further and say that sometimes you can even issue a contempt order when it's clear that the bezdin that's chosen by the defendant is not as bezdin that the defendant has any business choosing. Like, for example, the defendant is part of a modern Orthodox community, and the defendant chooses a Hasidish bezdin that from Williamsburg that they never heard of before, but somebody whispered in their ear that it's a divorce case and this is a bezdin that has a reputation for being much more favorable to his husband, so something like that. So if the feeling is, and I'm not saying that there's any such bezdin in Williamsburg that exists, I'm just giving you a highly theoretical example, but under those circumstances, some dayanim say that if it's felt that the choice of the bezdin by the defendant is one which is highly outrageous, then under those circumstances, and this is the only bezdin that they're agreeing to go to, even if it's within the range of respectability, that it would be a possibility for the original bezdin that sent out the summons on behalf of the plaintiff to come to the conclusion that a contempt order is appropriate under these circumstances. Now, assuming that it's really not right for the nitpa to just hold his ground and say, no, I'm only going to go to this bezdin, so what do we expect of the nitpa? In an ideal world, as I said, the batei din would work together. I've worked together with other batei din in forming Dinei Torah where the two parties couldn't agree on a particular bezdin. But if the batei din can't work together, and that's not the direction that it's going, so that's where we have Zabla, and that's the Gemara in Sanhedrin that talks about, if you take a look in source Yud, says, Kishizeh bo'lo dayan echad, zeh bo'lo dayan echad. It's viewed as like a magical, beautiful world, where each party, we say, okay, we're not going to have a joint bezdin over here, but we will have each side choose a dayan, and those two dayanim will choose a third dayan. And the Gemara says this is really a wonderful thing, because when each person chooses their own dayan shnei, and then those two dayanim choose a third dayan, yetzei hadin la'amito, this is going to be the most perfect, the most stellar, the most pristine and wonderful verdict that you can possibly achieve in the case. Because everybody has the dayanim that they want, and they're all working together, and everybody's going to see the merits in, you know, whatever merits exist in the arguments of the two sides, and then you'll have this third impartial dayan, so everything is going to be perfect. So if you look in source tests, so Igros Moshe Feinstein asked the question, can we say even nowadays that either party would have the right to insist upon a Zabla proceeding? If you look in source Ches, okay, that's Simon Gimel Sif Alf Neshulchan Aruch, so we say that when is it that there is a right to have a Zabla? Nearly Dafka B'dayarim She'enim that Kavuim. When I don't have a Bezdin Kavu, I don't have an established Bezdin in the city. But if I have an established Bezdin in the city, then neither party has the right to insist upon a Zabla. So Rav Moshe Feinstein asked the question, what about nowadays? So take a look here. He says, that which the Ramah says, that if you do have an established Bezdin in the city, then you can't really have a Zabla process. That's only with respect to the cities where there was actual governance and autonomy given to the Dayanim by the governmental authorities. Where somebody was appointed as the Rav Ha'ir, it was like the Rav of Krakow, the Rav of Minsk, the Rav of Brisk, whatever it was, so he was given an automatic authority over the residents of the city. They understood a Rav came to town. What did it mean that a Rav came to town? It didn't mean, oh, a Rav came to town, so now I have, you know, somebody to speak at, you know, the bar mitzvahs and the sheva brachos. It meant a Rav came to town, and he's going to adjudicate our cases. That's what it meant, that the Rav is coming to town. Everybody was accepting that person as their judicial authority. But New York, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, the halakhic term, New York. But New York, Lake of Dayarim Kibuim. There's no Dayarim Kibuim. There was no official established Bezdin that was set up in New York. They tried to have an official chief rabbi of New York, and that didn't really work out well at all. They brought him by Jacob Joseph to be the chief rabbi in the early 20th century, and he tried to regulate Shechita, and he got shechted. Well, in New York, Leka Dayarim Kibuim, Shenismanu Me'ir, there is no such thing. There are agudos. We know there's agudos of Abanim, there's igud of Abanim, there's agudos Yisrael, lots of agudos, and there are lots of agudos, v'chaburos of Abanim, lots of different groups of Abanim. You have the Rabbinical Council of America, you have lots of other different groups, you have Young Israel. Shaleka Afmino Mikola Abanim should be here. There's no consensus among all the rabbis of the city. So we can have such a thing as Zabla, even Bizman is there. Even nowadays, there's the possibility of having this type of a Zabla mechanism. The problem is, the Zabla mechanism, even though in theory it's Yetzei Din La'amito, it doesn't always work out that well so perfectly. If you take a look in Rashi here, source Yud Aleph, Sanhedrin Daf Chok Gimel Amud Aleph, so he says, why is it Yetzei Din La'amis La'amito? Because since the Dayanim are participating in the selection of the judges, so you figure that would work out well. Decisively, they'll therefore be respectful of the judgment, and they will follow the judgment. Because they'll figure, each one will figure, I participated in the convening of this Bezdin. And if the judge that I selected could have found merit in my position, and then he would have argued it. And the Dayanim themselves are going to try to find arguments in favor of those who selected them, so therefore everybody feels comfortable that their case will be fully fleshed out. So the Rosh in Source Yud Beis over here, on that Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Kof Gimel, says a lot of people make a mistake. They misinterpret this Rashi. And they think that it means that the dayan who's selected by one party is supposed to litigate an advocate on behalf of that party, but that's not at all what it means. And therefore, what ends up happening, and what the Rush said in the 13th, 14th century, is unfortunately what ends up happening even today in the 21st century. V'nagu kama anashim, the people, when they choose their borer, they're not choosing an exemplary dayan of objectivity who is known to be completely impartial, but rather, Nagu kama anashim, libo lehem, baal tachpulos. They find people who are masters of sophistry. They find lawyers. Instead of appointing Dayanim, they're appointing the lawyers. And this is what ends up happening in the Zabulus. Everybody picks a Borer, they pick a Dayan to represent them, and they pick a Toin, a rabbinic advocate to represent them as well. So I remember, so our policy at the Bezdin, along the lines of the Rosh, is that no, even the Borerim have to be objective individuals. So I remember once I had a person who presented their choice of Borer. They said, I want Rabbi so-and-so to be my Borer, and I want Rabbi so-and-so to be my Toin. I said, but the problem is, but your Borer regularly serves as a Toin. So he says, oh, so you don't want him to be the Borer? So the one that I was going to select is my Toin, he'll be the Borer. The one that I chose is the Borer, he'll be the Toin. So I said, you just proved my point, that they're interchangeable. So you can't have this type of an individual serving as a Borer. And he says that this is a misinterpretation of Rashi. No, it's not the idea of Rashi is that the litigant will be comfortable feeling that they chose somebody who would see any merits in their argument. Aval Hadayan, look at the fourth line. I'm in the middle of the fourth line. Aval Hadayan Atzmo Chalilo Limtzos Svar L'Zakoso. Im Lo Shiur Lo Din Gomer. The Dayan himself is not allowed to argue in favor of a particular position unless, objectively speaking, that position has merit to it. That is all that Rashi meant, is that if there is merit to the position, so the Dayan would have found it. But not that you should pick somebody who's a Baal Tachbulos, who's only going to advocate on behalf of that party. So Piskei Tshuva in Source Yud Gimel adds two other problems with Zablus. One problem is that often the Borerim, who are selected because of the fact that they are selected to be advocates, end up engaging in ex parte communications with the people who selected them. And the third problem is that they get paid money by the parties who selected them. And for a Dayan to get paid money by the party who selected them, according to halacha, that's considered to be what?
Shochad.
Right. Shochad is bad. Shochad is very, very bad. And that ruins the entire judgment. Okay. You cannot have bribery in the context of a Din Torah proceeding. So the Aruch HaShulchan Source Yudalit says, well, as far as the ex parte problem is concerned, he says the following, and this is really, I think, I wouldn't call it a sad commentary, but it's just a sobering commentary. Let's put it that way. The second line of the Aruch HaShulchan, he says, Mekol Makom Farnagu. He says it's already the minug, right? Somehow, sometimes Osios minug Gehinim, right? So it's already the minug. She called Echon Matzia Ta'anosav, that every single person engages in ex parte communications with the person that they chose as their borer, the thing borer shalom. Bekimen sheshnei atzadim, since everybody's doing it, right? If everybody does it, it must be okay. Bekimen sheshnei atzadim osim kaim, since both sides do this, that's the minhag, that's what Jews do. Who? Habekiilu kiblu aleihem shnei atzadim. So therefore, it's as if, therefore, it's like there was a Kabbalah that everybody just accepted it, even though they didn't have to accept it upon themselves, but they accepted it. So this, and then he just gives as a warning, as far as the mumminess is concerned, that when the Borerim get paid, they should get paid not only if they win, but even if they lose, because otherwise they'll have an incentive to, you know, only advocate on behalf of the party who chose them. But you could see all the problems that are out there. So Rabbi Willig, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who's a Skana Bezdin of the Bezdin of America, has pointed out, if this is based on Kabbalah, so a party can say, I'm not the Kabbalah! Party can say, I don't want that. I don't want that type of a Zabla. He doesn't want that type of a Zabla. So we would say he's not obligated to take him upon himself that type of a Zabla where the Boer is going to engage in ex parte communications. If one side says, I'm not going to engage in ex parte communications with my Boer, so then the other side is not allowed to engage in ex parte communications either. And if the feeling is that the nature of the Boer who is selected by the other side is one who really is going to be a rabbinic advocate in this particular fashion, so then the person who doesn't want to have that type of a Zabla proceeding can say, this is not what I want, in which case the Bezdin, under those circumstances, would give a heter or kos. At least our batitin would say that we would give a heter or kos to allow a person to go to civil court rather than subject themselves to that type of a Zabla proceeding, which is why it's much better, and this is the approach that I strongly endorse, that when the parties can't agree on a particular Bezdin, the two batidin should come together, like we did with the Rabbinical Council of California, to form a joint Bezdin made up of objective dayanim, rather than having a Zabla type of Bezdin, which would not necessarily be made up of a dayanim who are fully objective in terms of their associations.
Two things. One, just by virtue of selecting a person, it creates a bias in the relationship immediately. You know, I pick you as opposed to somebody else. Subconsciously in there's already a certain connection between them.
You know what? You have to differentiate between biases and biases. You know, so there's a certain amount that we feel would not necessarily join this a person's objectivity and the ability to hear the case. Mm-hmm. But then there's another type of association where they're getting paid money, where there's where it's a different, you know, type of concern.
The other solution to something like this, instead of having one dayan, have a pool of dayanim, and a person can arbitrarily pick a name out of that.
Right, so Rabbi J. David Bleich has the following suggestion. What he wanted to suggest is, he says that what we need in America is one giant Beis Din Kavua for the entire Jewish community. This is kind of like his grand utopian vision. And the way this Beis Din would function is that there would be a huge roster of hundreds of dayanim who are all vetted and considered to be honorable and respectable dayanim, and every single case that would be brought, the parties would be able to choose from, say, this roster of 250 dayanim, and each one would get to choose one dayan from that roster, and then the two dayanim would choose the third dayan from the roster, and this way you would have a Beis Din Hashava, a Beis Din that would be agreeable to a very, very large swath of the community. So that's Rabbi Black's proposal, and it's not a bad proposal.
What I'm saying is a little different. Instead of a person picking a specific dayan, you have a pool and let him pick a name out anonymously or at random.
A lottery.
A lottery,
yeah. Oh, let him pick from a lottery. But effectively, that's the way an institutional Beis Din works. An institutional Beis Din has 10 competent dayanim, and as long as the parties submit to that Beis Din, the Beis Din just selects the dayanim whom they think would be appropriate to the case. But if the idea is that the parties will be more likely to be comfortable with a system where they get to choose the particular dayanim, so this was Rabbi Bleich's proposal. But that proposal was out. We published an article about this a number of years ago, and I think that if all the major Bate Din got together and, you know, maybe could work on some type of a joint arrangement along these lines, then I don't think it would necessarily be a bad idea, particularly in those cases where they can't otherwise agree upon a smaller institutional Beis Din. I would be in favor of this type of arrangement in a case where the parties are coming from different directions and wouldn't otherwise be able to agree on a particular Beis Din. I don't know that necessarily needs to happen in every single case.
It's a national roster of judges in different places. You're going to force the judge to come.
Okay, so then you would have some sort of a fund where the expenses of the judges would be paid for, or, you know, the parties would all agree to go to some sort of a central location. So these are all different proposals and ideas to consider. Okay, Mietz Hashem, we'll continue next time, 2 weeks from today. As I mentioned, next week I'm going to be out in Mietz Hashem, but 2 weeks from today.
Okay.